Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet and editor Jack Hopper. Hopper has published three collections of poetry. His first, Miscellany, appeared in 1962. His most recent is called Doubles, Poems 1995 to 2012, published in October by Cuga Lake Press. Hopper founded and co-edited a literary journal called Works, a Quarterly of Writing, from 1967 to 1974, and published such luminaries as Sam Shepard, Diane Wachowski, Robert Creeley, and Anise Nin. His plays have been performed by Dutch Radio and at Manhattan's Café La Mama ETC in New York. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, you've been writing and editing poetry for most of your life, so what sparked your interest in this genre?
In poetry,
yeah.
I don't know. I wanted to be a history teacher originally, and it's still kind of my first love.
Huh.
But poetry was in the blood for a long, long time as a teenager. I read a lot of stuff when I was a young romantic.
Uh-huh.
Now I'm an old romantic, and I'm still reading it, but writing a lot more, too.
So who introduced you to poetry, though? Did you get introduced to it when you were a young
man? I don't think
so.
I think I just stumbled on it. You know, we had some books lying around the house. And good bookstores in Philadelphia, where I grew up. And I just love to wander through these things and find things.
Yeah.
And good teachers, of course, which I was
lucky
to have, especially in high school.
Because it seems so almost unusual for me, for somebody who was, you know, coming of age in the 40s and 50s, to be introduced or encouraged to write poetry, especially a young man.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I was encouraged. My parents always said, why don't you become a teacher? And then you can write in your spare time.
Ah.
I've since known many teachers who laughed, of course. Spare time doesn't really exist.
Yeah, I know it.
You know, stacks of papers to correct and whatnot.
And you know what? That still happens today. People think of poetry as a hobby instead of a profession.
Exactly.
It's,
yeah.
It's
right.
Amazing to me. Now, did you start actually showing your poetry to people early on? How did that transpire?
Well, apart from school magazines, you know, the kind of student things, I got involved in a literary group as soon as I hit Paris, actually, after the army in 1959. And there were a lot of people who had just left, you know, the beats and so forth had left, but there were a lot of other people who had come in. I got to know a lot of writers that way, and they were very encouraging, very, very good. This helped me get along. I was more interested in prose, really, at the time.
Oh, really?
The great American novel.
Uh-huh.
But the poetry came and came, and finally in 62, the first collection came together.
Wow, that's amazing. Do you remember what some of the early poems were about? What were you writing about? Were you writing about politics or culture?
No, not much politics, no. Mostly myself, sex, pursuit, mm-hmm. whatever.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of some historical things that I slipped in there, too. I was interested, too, in experimenting. I was very interested in working in sonnets, the more formal things. It was still training, a lot of that.
Oh, yeah.
And it showed in the book. I think sometimes to my advantage and sometimes not.
No, well, everybody goes through a training period. You have to get
sure
to know
did.
Your own voice, it seems to me.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Well, I want you to read a poem from your new book called Doubles. This one's called Ceremonies of Youth. Do you want to tell us a bit about it before you read it?
Yeah. I've always been a very physical person, whether I was running when I was in high school or biking or swimming. It comes through in this because I always associate it with younger people or people who are trying to stay young physically
uh-huh.
and resist old age, which I'm entering or have entered. So this is really about that. This was written a good 10, 15 years ago, just after the second collection came out. Ceremonies of Youth. Delicious fatigue, the sweat running along your skin. The wind will not keep your hair dry and will push against you, often the wrong way, often it seems in your face and never at your back. But think of it, what lies ahead? Whatever you call home, the cold drink or the coffee hot against the winter, if it is winter you are running, biking, pushing against, to play with age, to escape the phones and the yammer of children and the wife for whom you are one of the children. And here you come. You've beaten time again, a minute or more, from the last time, and you peel the racing clothes from your limbs, and you scoop off the shoes and stand, catching the profile of your chest, the legs sinewy and trembling a little, like a run-out colt. And then to confession in the shower stall, adjusting the water, feeling it catch your hair, scalp, sex, ears, in an eddy that gives you the shivers, and it covers you with a luminous coat, and forgives you, and celebrates you, and the glass is so fogged it can only see your happiness darkly.
Oh, I love that. I love that ending. That's great.
I love the push of it, the force of it. It just.
Uh-huh. Now tell me how you work. Did you polish a lot? Does magic come to you in flowing ebbs?
I wouldn't say the writing is the easy part. It isn't, but of course that moment has to come. And once it's down, it happens almost immediately. Something that's obviously piled up, and it suddenly has to come out.
Uh-huh.
And then the work begins, of course, cutting through it with a machete of editing.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that, much more.
First it's the magic, and then it's the clarity, is the way I put it always in regard to work.
Right.
Now, you founded the literary magazine in 1967 called Works, A Quarterly of Writing. Mm-hmm. To tell us about what you were looking for. You know, there were a lot of journals being produced at that point. What were you trying to do in that moment?
Well, I got a job as an editor with a friend of mine from school, actually, who was just starting a new academic press. And it wasn't exactly a condition of my employment, but I said, if you want me, I want a literary magazine. So this man, thinking he was getting Esquire, I think, or something like that, said, sure, and very generously backed it. And we brought out about 14 issues. The idea was to publish really excellent people, excellent work, not the names. We weren't interested in that. In fact, we got poetry, we got prose from people who were very much established and sometimes very angry when they were rejected because we didn't like their work.
Ah.
Or some stranger came along and, hey, let's do this. It's a great short story. And that was the whole thing. So it didn't last that long because we were not Esquire. But it made its 14 issues, had a good-looking corpse, and that was the end of it.
Oh, I think it's wonderful to even try to do something like that. I mean, there's so many voices that never get heard.
Right.
Now, do you think that's kind of a treacherous thing that happens if a writer becomes established, their work can be published, whether it's good or bad? Did you learn that while you were doing this kind of editing and work?
No, I never tried to use, for example, I never tried to use my position as an editor to try and get my poetry published elsewhere, but some people did.
Yeah.
You could feel that, trying to use their thing.
The reason why I ask is because I sometimes do see established writers being published in places like The New Yorker, and I don't think it's good work.
I'm thinking they
must not be edited now because they're so famous.
Yeah, very disappointing sometimes.
That's interesting to me that people don't know how to self-edit. You know what I was interested in, too, that you published Anise Nin. Had she been known then? Because I found out about her in the 70s,
of course. She was pretty well known, partly through Henry Miller and that crowd. And I first met her in Paris, actually, at a signing signature party she had. So I got to know her more when she came to New York and lived around NYU.
Uh-huh.
And her husband, who was her illustrator, actually, through all that, was a banker. Oddly,
he married Anise Nin as a banker.
She was wonderful, wonderful person.
And what did you publish some of her prose or short stories?
Yeah, we published something of hers. Honestly, I can't remember. It's been so long. But I was just very happy to have her.
And she's kind of a fascinating enigma to a lot of us who are younger and kind of got turned on to her. Yeah.
Fit right into the 60s.
I read all of her journals, every one of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was one of my favorite things from my young adulthood, yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
Now, let's have you read another from Doubles. This one, this seems very personal. It's called Pilgrimage. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, my wife died in 2004 of cancer, and my goal was to go back to Paris with the ashes and to let them go in the River Seine, and that's what this is about.
Mm.
I still haven't done it, but anyway, that's coming, I hope, maybe this spring. Pilgrimage. Martinis at the Ritz, where thin girl Audrey Hepburn trysted Cooper in the afternoon. Then dinner at some bistro that survived the march of change and small talk. A patron who remembers us with nods, or not. At last, round midnight, I'll walk you halfway over the Pont Neuf, down steps where, seen only by chance lovers on the quay, some passing tug, I will consign your ashes to the Seine's complicit hug.
Wow. That's a beautiful poem. You often wonder if somebody's writing something personal or something about someone else that moves them. You know, I interviewed Audrey Enrich once, and she said that the reader shouldn't necessarily believe that the I in most poems is the author. How do you feel about that? Are you writing universal, too, as well as personal?
Oh, I am. I mean, they're very personal. That's the origin of them, of course. But as you write, you begin to realize there's a universality about what you're doing. You hope it is.
Uh-huh.
That means that you are expanding your audience beyond yourself.
Uh-huh. And you have kids, right?
I do. I have two sons.
Have they read some of these poems? What do they think about
the one
about your mom? Really?
I sent them each copies, and they said they liked the covers so far, but they haven't really gotten back to me. My older son has, actually. He likes some of them, I know.
Yeah, because it is so personal. Sometimes kids might be a little prickly about, why are you talking about mom with strangers, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, they're 32 and 42 at this age, at this time, so they're old enough to understand, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe forgive.
Yeah. Well, to tell us a little bit more about this new collection, how did you compile it? It doesn't seem to have a particular theme. It's wrapped around years.
This is a wonderful question because I asked the same question of myself. How do I arrange these things?
Uh-huh.
The second book was kind of easy because I had about 30 or 40 years, it seemed, of things to, and I did it by decades.
Oh.
So there was an arc in each one of these things. I asked a friend of mine, Janet Sylvester, who's a published poet also, and I said, how would you go about it? She says, I just had some interesting advice looking toward her new book. She says, think of the whole book as a poem and each of the poems as a line. Well, this is a stretch, you know, it really is. But I tried to do that. I tried to, and I've had a couple of friends, not knowing this was my philosophy of arrangement, and they said that I could feel an arc in the book from the beginning where it's the young man in Paris running around and whatnot through marriage and then retirement, more or less, Ithaca, here, and writing. And uh-huh. That's what I wanted. Okay. So maybe it succeeded. I don't
yeah.
know.
Yeah. In these poems, are you writing more from memory?
Very much. But it's like as you pass through life, it's like being a hiker, and burrs will stick to you. And these are the ones you can't get off, or all of a sudden, they have to be noticed.
Yeah.
Something
yeah.
has to be done with them.
Yeah. Are you somebody who goes back and reads your stuff, or once you've written it, it's gone, and you're on to the new?
It's never really gone because, you know, I forget who said it, that a poem is never finished, it's only abandoned. This is very true, I think.
Yeah.
You show it, and you even when you publish it, somebody will say, did you really mean to say that? And you think about it, oh, well, maybe not quite that.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it's always being re-edited, always being. Auden did this. He was notorious for yanking poems from the collected works and that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
And going back and just chucking stuff. I've done it. Even with this, there are 60 poems in here, and I had probably 10 more. And I said, this is too much for the period of time it's supposed to represent. And I had such fun just jettisoning these things. You know? It's a great release.
But there's time to bring them out in another book,
oh,
right?
Of course,
because
sure.
it's
yeah.
still part
work
of your heart.
Work them up again and
yeah.
make them better.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, how do you write? Does a line come to you while you're taking a walk? Are you constantly...
Many orphan lines, yes, that never get used. I always have a notebook, usually, certainly mm-hmm. by my bed. I rely on dreams. As you perhaps notice, there are a couple of dream poems in there
yeah.
that have no... They're almost embarrassing, and I don't care, you know. They're so wonderful because the mind just says, the heck with it, let go. You know, that's one source. But memory is the biggest. That's the one where these things just reemerge.
Uh-huh.
They come back up, and you think, oh, gosh, yes, I'd almost forgotten that.
Yeah. Oh, I love that you call them orphan lines. I'd never heard that term.
It was new to me. Somebody told me it's apparently an expression that's current.
Wow.
But it's such they're the lines you get, and you never really use them because they're not attached to anything yet.
Yeah.
And when
yeah.
you try to use them, sometimes they're awkward. They get rejected.
Yeah, and then you try to put them into a poem, and they don't fit just because you like
oh,
the
yeah,
line.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure all of us have done that.
You find that out in groups like the one I belong to, and they'll say, did you really want to use that line? And I said, yes, it's a great line. Take it out.
to tell us what you think about performance in poetry. I know the tradition has always been there. In fact, it was a spoken art probably more so than a written art in the early days. How important is that to learn how to perform your pieces persuasively?
I've listened to so many readings, some good readers, you know, from the Dylan Thomases, which are very, very rare, like or not like his poetry.
Uh-huh.
He's the greatest reader we've had.
That's what everybody always says. Yeah,
yeah,
I know. He is. I've listened.
He drank his way back to the point of when he wrote the poems, he says. And that's why these sound so good, whether it's true or not.
Wow.
It's a rather dangerous philosophy.
That's not something...
I certainly have tried to avoid. But I think it's so important that people celebrate their poetry, not try to swallow it or feel embarrassed about it because they're in front of a crowd. Give it to them, you know, throw it out to them.
Yeah, yeah. I understand what you mean. If you're just joining us, my guest is editor and poet Jack Hopper. We're reading from his new book, Doubles. Now, you were in the army in Paris in the late 50s. Tell us a little bit about that experience and how did that affect you as a writer?
They still had the draft back then. It was in 57.
Wow, they
and
did?
My graduate ideas had fallen through, so I knew I had to get this out of the way. And by several strokes of luck, I ended up in Orléans, 60 miles from Paris. and I was a passport carrier, which meant every weekend I went to Paris. So by the time that my 16 months in the army there were over, I knew I was coming back as a human being, as a civilian, and I did. I came back for 2 years and lived there and had just a wonderful time.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't write as much as I would like to.
I was going to ask you, because I mean, that's every writer's dream, you know, Hemingway and all those writers from that era.
I was stuffing my head with a lot of memories already. I knew that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And do you think it changed you, though, as a writer? Did it deepen
Absolutely.
Your experience?
It put me on the path, definitely. Teaching was something I really wanted to do. I really enjoy sharing something I feel enthusiastic about, whether it's English poetry or history. And I'm sorry, in a sense, to have lost that. But it's crept into the poetry, too. If I can bother somebody who will listen, I'll send them the poem and anxiously await their comments. And people have been generous that way.
Uh-huh.
So it's been a great experience.
Well, I want to actually have you read a poem from Doubles. This one's called Veterans Day. This pertains to what we were just talking about, your experience in the
Army. This is an Ithaca poem, too.
It's a great poem. I love it.
Oh, thank you.
Do you want to tell us a little tiny bit about it before you read it?
Sure. I was stationed in Louisville, in Fort Knox, back in 1957 and 58. And we had a rifle team, and the prize was a 3-day weekend in Louisville. So that was important. I just thought, oh, well, this would be better than sitting in the barracks. So I went, and we were all good at it. We won second prize or something. I don't know what it was. 4 days in Louisville, maybe. But anyway, This came up again, and when this happened, I couldn't stand it after the first set with this marching business. And I finally just, as they gave a command for reversing the entire line so they go the other way, I kept walking. And everybody piled up, and that was the end of my career as a marcher.
That's a version of a different drummer,
back,
right?
Yeah. But it came back when my friend asked me, you know, do you want to join me for the Veterans Day thing here? And I said, I don't think so. You know, I certainly had nothing against veterans, but it was the whole fanfare. We were still in the middle of war. Well, we still are, you know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that got to me a bit. And I knew that Oscar, wonderful Oscar, would understand. So that's kind of the genesis of it. Veterans Day for Oscar. Thinking I was patriotic because I was a soldier years before, my friend reminds me that it's Veterans Day, a ceremony at the park, he says, then a buffet and cheap drinks at the post. I'll see you. I dragged my feet, just as I had years back, a member of a drill team that won a contest at some army post, then went the opposite way on a command on purpose and was dismissed, not worth the weekend pass to Louisville. I'm 73. I didn't like it then, and I don't like it now. My friend will somehow understand, and we'll meet again to hear jazz and gospel, but not fife and drum coming down the street where history keeps repeating itself again and again.
That's great. That's so apropos to today.
Oh, yes.
When did you actually write that?
When I was 73. I'm 70. What am I? 5 years ago.
Ah, because it's so appropriate right now.
Actually,
Wow, that's amazing. Do you think politics should come into poetry? I mean, a lot of artists debate about that. Some say, no, it's supposed to be something beautiful to transcend, you know, from everyday problems. But what do you think?
I do, but they must come in naturally. They must come in from a force of conviction. When they're written as protest things, they're like anything else. Will you write a poem for my daughter's wedding? This sort of thing.
Oh,
it usually doesn't work. And most of the poetry that I read like that doesn't work. There are very few people like Phil Oakes, who was a great, I thought, protest singer.
Oh, yeah, and Bob Dylan, of course.
I know, but then all of a sudden, poor Phil ran out of things to protest and committed suicide. This doesn't happen with the poets. They just keep on writing. But sometimes it works. Sometimes the stuff is good. I can't think of anybody offhand, but if it has a real, genuine origin and conviction, it might be worth it.
Yeah, so you don't think poets and artists should stay away from politics by any means?
Absolutely not. No, it's impossible to anymore, I think, and say you live in the world.
I think so, too, because, you know, the personal is political, that old adage from the 60s.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I've heard some debate recently, and people are questioning whether poetry means anything, whether it can change anything, what do you think about that at this point? Somebody said that after the poet spoke at Obama's inauguration, and the poem I thought was absolutely gorgeous.
I think it's always relevant. I don't know how big an audience it is. I think there's more people writing poetry today, just writing period, but especially poetry, than ever before. There's so many magazines.
Mm-hmm. Online magazines have certainly cropped up. Yeah,
this too. And this is going to change the face of book publishing, of course, too. An agent friend of mine said, in 5 years, publishing's going to change.
Oh, I'm sure.
So I don't know how that'll affect poetry, but I think it will definitely go on. I don't think the audience is entirely poets. I know they aren't.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people, certainly up here in Ithaca, this is very true. People read poetry never having written it.
Yeah.
So as long as we have that cadre of believers.
Yeah. Well, I still think it's a vibrant voice, you know, because it doesn't pound you in the face like, you know, like reading a speech would.
No, right.
And it's a gentle way of waking people up in some ways.
Yeah, so I think so, yeah. I don't think we've had as vital a time as we did in the 60s when we had the Ginsbergs and the Kerouacs and so forth. They were so dynamic and revolutionary, truly. You know, they were really breaking away from the confessional poems of Robert Lowell, whom I still like very much. But they were really rocking the boat a lot. And I don't feel that. I don't feel that happening today. But there's a great variety of very interesting.
Well, why do you think that is, though, that there hasn't been a voice?
I think we've emerged of almost acceptance too much of things. We've accepted the wars that we've been getting into and wagging our heads about it. You know, it's refreshing to be in Ithaca. I must say, there are people who really espouse causes, whether it's anti-fracking and that kind of thing. Uh-huh. They really believe it. You know.
Oh yeah. Oh, there's a great activism in this town. Yeah, and a great arts community in this town too, which gives voice.
I had a fantasy that I'd be walking along and I actually saw the sign that said "End Road Work," and I thought I can just see an Ithacan picking this up and starting to walk with it, and after two blocks you'll have a following of 30 or 40 people. End road work. This is commitment.
Well, what do you think about some of the new voices in poetry, like rap and?
It's all part of it. I like it. A neighbor of mine has a son, Dan Lisby, who has the Gun Poets.
Oh yeah.
And I like them. I don't like a lot of the rap because it's offensive. It's offensive to women. It's offensive to people.
Yeah.
You know, it's not even protest.
Yeah.
But Dan's stuff is just one thing, and there were others like him, I'm sure, that have a real message that they want to get across. So it's a good message.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's important.
Yeah, I think there are many great voices.
Anything that works.
People walking out of academia and not conforming to right. what they're supposed to be writing. Yeah. Now, yeah. I want to have you read one final poem. This is the title poem. It's called Doubles. Do you want to tell us a bit about it again?
Yeah, this is an interesting poem. In a sense, I'm playing with the idea of the doppelganger, you know, mon somme blabla, mon frère from Baudelaire, this kind of thing, my double, my brother. And I was looking for this kind of thing. When I was in high school, I had the good fortune to have a really great high school. And when I went to college, the first semester, the teachers didn't seem to be up to par. I hadn't met anybody that was interesting, you know, that I could sit down and really talk with. And all of a sudden, I met this one guy. And he's become a lifelong friend. He lives in the West Coast now. It's about this. Of course, I pitched it into our time today, so I'm an older person. Doubles. Love is rarer than genius itself, and friendship is rarer than love. A line by Charles Peguy. He's considering a hearing aid. In dreams, smokes cigarettes. Remembers exactly when his wife died, lying right beside him, gasping, the last person to share his bed. Suddenly enters a stranger bearing books. Cross-legged they sit, discussing movies, novels, poems, disputing the universe, yet always settling on the same hemisphere. By the time he emerges, he shouldn't be allowed to drive a car. So fogged is his windshield, and his feet that want to dance confuse the brake with go. He will drive home, survive a snowstorm in which all the alphabets of all the languages in the universe are falling softly and without a word.
Wow. That's kind of a sad poem, though, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. I like the explosiveness of it. He's happy.
Yeah.
I was happy back then. And meeting people like that is a wonderful thing.
Oh, know? Yeah.
Really
oh,
is.
Yeah. You meet somebody that you really,
again,
really connect with.
3 cheers for Ithaca.
Yeah, exactly.
They're walking around.
Do you send your work out still and suffer the rejections? How do you deal with that?
I do. I found a place that's published out of Kingston in the Church of the Hudson Valley called Chronogram. Mm. And they started publishing my stuff, and they seem to have liked. They picked up five of them, which are in the book here. But I'm trying to break away from them and get back into some other things. It's very hard to get published. Very hard. I'm beginning to use other people that I know. You know, could you, if you know so-so with such and such a review, you know, what do you think? I should do more. The book is helping right now. It's giving me a little bit more of an audience. I have readings coming up, one in Brooklyn where I lived for 20 years. So it'll be interesting to see how many of my old friends come out to that.
Yeah. So you still dare to send out. You know, I know lot of young writers who say, I'm afraid to do that.
It's a pain in the neck. You know, I have a wonderful collection of rejection slips going way back. My favorite was something came back and somebody had written across the poem or short story I had sent, not meaning to send it. Reject politely. Use adjectives like interesting.
Really? Oh, my God.
That almost makes it worth sending them out. You know?
Uh-huh. Well, how do you deal with rejection, though? Did you just say, okay, that's that, and send the poem out again? That's generally how I deal with rejections.
The next one. Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't even think twice about it.
Yeah.
I'm not doing as much as I used to, but now I'm going to get back into it.
Do you ever write reviews of poetry? It seems to me you have such a body of experience
as an
editor as well that you would have some authority.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I haven't reviewed much at all. I would enjoy that. I would actually enjoy that.
The internet has all these opportunities. I think people should think beyond their art and think about doing other things
I am about to review a novel of a friend of mine, Fred Wilcox, who's a local.
Yes, I've had him on the show.
Yeah, I have.
I want to ask you this, too. What would you recommend to a young writer is one of the attributes that they should have to pursue this well?
Listen to everything. Put your head down and don't listen to anybody else who doesn't like it. Just keep plowing ahead. And look up occasionally, make sure you don't hit a wall. but apart from that, stay with it. Stay with it. It's a lonely profession, but it will get there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you'll get better if you stay with it.
Yeah.
It always happens, whether you're a musician, whatever. Practice, practice, practice. You'll make it.
Yeah, and do you recommend that people dare to bring it out to the public, too?
Absolutely.
And share it with the community?
And fail. Dare to fail. That's the great part of it, you know.
Dare to
sometimes
fail.
You don't.
Yeah.
Sometimes it works.
Yeah. Well, Jack Hopper, we're almost out of time. Do you have any contact information, any readings you can tell people about in the region that they might be able to?
There's one coming up at Buffalo Books. It's in March the 26th, I think it is. It's Palm Sunday. That's all I remember.
Okay.
It is a Sunday. That's one. And there's one in the Trumansburg Library, I think the week just before that. That's about the 20th or the 19th or something.
Oh,
also
good.
Sunday. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, people can look for that in the date listings,
right,
and find you. Jack Hopper, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure. Keep on writing.
Thank you, Tish. Great to be here.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.